Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Welcome, everybody. This is David Lickin with Lickin on Lending. We appreciate you dialing in and or logging in or however the various ways that you can listen to this program. Maybe it's on a download, but we appreciate you being here with us again this week. A special thank you goes out to Alex Alvey, who stepped in and was acting or played the role of the host last week, the hostess with the mostest last week. We appreciate that so much, Alice, for being a part of it. I heard a lot of good feedback on last week's program. And we're going to start off this week, as we do each and every week, getting an update on rates. Joe, what's going on with MBS prices?
Hey, Dave. Hey, we're up today. Not a lot, but we're up from morning levels. We're currently up 3/32 on the day, and that may be enough for some of the more aggressively priced correspondents to be thinking about a repricing. So for the better. So no economic news to drive it, but we are up 5/32 above much of the morning, early morning level. So,
good way to start off the program.
Yeah, a good way to start the week, huh?
Yeah.
Somewhat similar to how we've been the last few weeks. Last week continued a string of 4 weeks of improving prices, and we're at the best prices of the year right now, and MBS and mortgage rates are as low as they've been all year.
That's good news as well, yes.
Yeah, the last week was a... had an interesting day on Friday, but up until then, most of the economic data that had come out had been fairly weak, and MBS prices improved each of the first few days of the week last week. Both the ISM index and the services index were below expectations, below the prior month at least, and then when jobless claims came out on Thursday, much higher than what was expected, we saw a really big improvement in prices. That also was the day that there's a little bit of weakness in well, actually, it was Friday. The jobs report was just very weak on Thursday, and we saw MBS prices improve. The Dow lost 140
points. Yeah.
And then a barrel of oil, the price of oil came down $10 a barrel. So that was a big market moving day. We've seen a lot of change in price for many of the commodities, especially silver had a bad week last week. But all that sort of had been driven by the beginning belief that, hey, the economy was not recovering all that quickly, and that the weakness in the reports earlier in the week kind of prompted people to downgrade their expectations for the jobs report on Friday. Then on Friday morning, when the jobs report came out, a good bit better than expected.
Yeah, showing growth. Yeah.
Yeah, we saw a knee-jerk reaction to a better than originally expected and a lot better than revised expected numbers. So we saw a pretty big reversal of prices. In fact, at one point Friday morning, prices for Friday had totally reversed all the gains that had happened prior in the week. But over the day on Friday, and somewhat because of the continuing problems with Greece's debt, MBS prices recovered their morning losses and ended the day about where they began the day. So a bit of volatility on Friday, and favorable price changes were seen after that big drop in prices. But investors, I think, are kind of wondering now which of the prices were more indicative, the solid jobs report or the prior weakness in the reports prior in the week. One note about the jobs report: there's been some analysis of the impact of what's called the the birth death ratio,
Yeah,
and its reaction on the number of jobs included in the in the report, and the expectation is that it kind of exaggerated the number of new jobs. And so that number, that 244,000 jobs created in March, is being challenged somewhat. So not quite as strong as what it would indicate otherwise. For the week, though, NBS prices improved about 60 basis points.
Yeah, so I was going to say, it's interesting we start analyzing births and deaths and things like that. Start adjusting our numbers.
Remember that is not of people, that is of companies or small businesses.
Oh, that's right.
The jobs report is ordinarily a survey based on large companies, and so they adjust that for small businesses by using some formula, and they call it the birth and death ratio of new small businesses being born and old or prior small businesses going out of business. So.
Good. It's good that we point that out. All right. So what about this week? What do we got coming up?
The first part of the week is going to be driven by the Treasury reports. We have the 3 and the 3rd and the 10 and the 30 auctions this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Also on Thursday, we have retail sales. And then Thursday and Friday, we have the two inflation reports, CPI and PPI. PPI on Thursday, CPI on Friday. And both those reports are expected to show pretty large overall numbers just because of the impact of the cost of gasoline and its impact on overall inflation. But then both core numbers, which excludes that, are expected to be or remain very low. We've seen them stay below 2% wouldn't be surprised to see the annual rate stay below 2%.
Which overall would be welcome news. April retail sales. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that's welcome news given that it sure helps the Fed keep rates low. April retail sales are supposed to be pretty good, but not quite as good as they were last year when you exclude last month. When you exclude, auto sales, which are always kind of volatile, retail sales are expected to be up 0.5% for the month.
All in all, it looks like we are still in a low-rate scenario, which is good for originations, and we certainly need all the encouragement we can to get as many of these originations and volumes back up to some decent levels. Joe, thank you so much for bringing us the report again. It was fun to be on the listening side of the program last week, and you all did a great job. Thanks so much for bringing us this update each and every week. Again, this is Dave Licken with Licken on Lending. It is. I failed to mention this at the top because a lot of people who are downloading the program listen for that early signal. It is May 9th for those of you that are listening on a download basis. A number of people download this on a repeated basis, listen to the program multiple times, or listen to a sequence of them while they're driving in a car on a road trip. So it's so that we're actually making some of your folks' road trips when you're out there listening to us. So we try to bring you as much relevant information. Again, this is created by mortgage professionals and definitely focused at the mortgage industry for mortgage professionals. We appreciate you listening each and every week. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about a report. I'll be bringing up the report from the National Secondary Marketing Conference. We're going to be talking about the call report, a lot of really interesting stuff that you're not going to want to miss. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Economic uncertainty has created a tremendous amount of market volatility for the past few weeks. Intraday price changes seem the rule rather than the exception. Have you been surprised by a midday price change? Have you been frustrated as you locked a loan just ahead of a price movement? Found it difficult to explain to a customer why the rate you quoted is no longer available? MBS Quoteline can eliminate these frustrations. MBS Quoteline monitors Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed security prices in real time. It makes the information conveniently available on your desktop, smartphone, or by email or text message. These are the same prices used to set mortgage rates each morning and to issue midday price changes when significant movement occurs. With MBS Quoteline, you'll never be out of touch with the market, whether you're in the office or on the road. See for yourself what MBS Quoteline can do for you. Go to mbsquoteline.com to start a risk-free two-week trial. mbsquoteline.com. 646-716-4972. The Licken on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Licken.
Welcome back, everybody. And each and every week, we bring you the legislative update, also known as the traffic report. It's like a traffic jam out there when it comes to legislative initiatives that are coming out of both Washington, D.C., and now we're seeing out of the state levels. And it is a traffic jam, to be certain, but helping us sort out the traffic jam, hovering in her helicopter overhead. You need to put in some background music, Laura. Alice, with you hovering over the traffic jam, give us an update. So what's the latest? What is there anything new out there, or are we just tracking some old stuff still stuck in the pipeline?
Oh, we have both. So, you know, I have to start with the one that's the big tension point, which is credit risk retention. So this is our big piece of Dodd-Frank that has, and that's the formal title of the proposal. So if you want to look this up and make comments, it's the credit risk retention, and it is posted in the Federal Register 76 FR 24090, if you want to write that down, 24090. You can Google it or whatever search engine you want, but the credit risk retention is the piece that we're watching right now. Comments have to be in by June 10th. This is going to take you a while to formulate your thoughts, and we need you to comment on this. I was so surprised as to how many people haven't really commented yet. I found a few out there, but, you know, again, let me give you some pointers here on this. The 5% risk retention today is, you would, as a lender, you would be exempt from retaining 5% of the value of the loan, of the loan amount, in reserves at your company if the loan met certain exemptions. And I think many of you have heard by now that a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan would be exempt, and so would an FHA, VA, and RD loan. But they still have to, within the law, come up with the definition, because we know Fannie and Freddie aren't going to be in conservatorship forever. When they come out, we're going to lose that exemption. So we have to care about this definition right now. The definition gets
very
into
important
underwriting, and product features. And just as a, you know, as a high point, we talked about it in more detail last week, so maybe go listen to last week's show if you want to hear some more about it. But they're looking at setting ratios at 28-36. My line is, who has those ratios today? I'm a DUNLP approved way above that. So do we want really in writing that we think this is a reasonable set of ratios to lock things down with? I think the LTVs are the biggest criteria that we have a leg to stand on. They're looking to set that it's an 80% LTV on purchases. You know, what is wrong with a 90 LTV with mortgage insurance? I think as an industry we have to get behind that. That's a reasonable LTV. We also need to look at the LTV for refinances, capped at a 75. You know, think how many consumers would be trapped. I mean, we have little equity as it is in most parts of the country. How are we going to get to 75? I mean, no one's going to have the opportunity to refi at that point. So really play to, you know, understanding how it impacts your consumers and respond to that one. Along with it, and sometimes this gets confusing, there's a separate proposed rule under Reg Z for qualified mortgages. This comment period expires July 21st. So take care of your comments to risk retention first, then understand QM. QM being applying, you know, community banks and credit unions need to pay attention to this, because this is all financing. And this is, if we don't have a qualified mortgage, if you close a loan that does not meet qualified mortgage definitions, which means I've proven my borrower has the ability to repay. Think about that. Think about the liability as an originator and lender of any type, right? Yes, I swear this person's going to pay me back, and here's the underwriting rules we've used. So there's a lot of conflicting information in QM. We'll devote more time to that in future shows. I got to get through kind of my whole list here. Right? So please, we'll spend another show on going through the details of QM, but for right now, make sure you focus on the credit risk retention piece. Now, we're watching a lot of bills. It's getting a little press right now about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, with one person in charge of that very powerful organization. And we are in agreement. I shouldn't speak for you guys. I don't know how all of you feel, but I feel that it makes more sense as we have two bills. We have House Bill 1121 and Senate Bill 737 that are proposing to replace the director of the CFPB with a five-person commission. Now, obviously, we want our voice to be heard on who should be in that commission, what should make up that, instead of just one individual making final decisions. So let's watch that one closely. That's getting some press in the news. Another piece of litigation that just occurred, Buckley Sandler's InfoBytes. They always have some good information. They're reporting.
Great information there.
Yeah, they do. I like to read that. They're reporting the U.S. has files a False Claim Act lawsuit against Deutsche Bank and subsidiary Mortgage IT. So this was a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank that did a lot of FHA lending. They filed this on May 3rd for $1 billion under the False Claim Act for the insurance claims. This is going back for 10 years worth of FHA business, $39,000 mortgages they are now saying should not have been underwritten or should not have been approved and closed. And they're even referencing, you know, to me when I read this, it looks like, wow, are they actually going after underwriters in this too? So it's huge because not just
That's
the dollar
huge.
Amount, but it's not going through the regular channels. You know, usually when you're in trouble with HUD, you stay within HUD. This is out in court, and so I think there are going to be some webinars and services to watch out for on how am I liable under the False Claim Act in addition to, you know, just trying to follow FHA guidelines. So I think that's a historic case that we definitely have to watch. Some deadlines coming up that you also have to make sure you're watching. FHA's $1 million net worth deadline is May 20th for all companies. There is a $500,000 exemption for a small business. That small business exception is going to be around till 2013. If you've already renewed at the $1 million, you're fine. It's for those of you who might have been hanging out there with lower net worths under approvals that hadn't expired. So you want to check and make sure what your status is going to be upon renewal. Another piece with FHA is the DE approval. There is an expiration on July 1st. FHA currently allows a non-DE lender to utilize a principal-agent relationship. So, Dave, you know how people go through test cases?
Yep.
I get my mortgagee status approval, which everybody's working to. Then I have to go through my 15 test cases. Today, you can use a principal-agent in that window. You can use another DE lender to help you get a loans underwritten. That's the part that's going away July 1st. There isn't really a panic button for anybody who is not even in that world yet. If you're new to mortgagee status, you're going to be recently entering your case studies, then all that means to you is you've got to finish your case studies and do your own underwriting during that 15 loan stage. And once you're finished with you actually earn your DE, then you can set up relationships to help you with your volume after that with other DE lenders. So not as big a panic point as I think I've read some articles trying to scare people with. If you have any questions on that, don't hesitate to call. And then last but not least, I know, Dave, you and Andy have talked about this a lot, the NMLS deadline of the call reports. Your first quarter information is due, Sunday, so we'll call it Monday, May 16th, right? And when you go to the NMLS website, I don't see anything about extensions. Some people are talking extensions. Andy, I know you want to jump in here and let people know, you know, give people kind of a heads up. Should they be filing if they're a state agency? So it applies to companies that hold a state license or state registration, and you can check this list out on the NMLS. If I haven't registered yet, should I be worried about it?
You know, Alice, from my perspective, it's better to do it on time than to do it late and wonder what's going to happen. Dave talked about this coming out of the conference on the webinar that he and I taught on Tuesday. There was some talk about it. Like you said, there's nothing on the NMLS that says it's delayed. Every state agency could change, I suppose, but the NMLS deadline is still the same. And so, frankly, I would just do it right the first time. Why run the risk? We're hearing all kinds of horror stories about the potential risk of late filing. And all we've got to do, this is just the activity report that's due on the 15th, unless you're a Fannie Freddie seller servicer issuer, in which case you've already been filing the MBFRF form anyway. But if you're new to this, you just have to file that activity report. So, you know, go back, look at all the application activity, determine the dispositions, run the numbers, and you know, my recommendation is just why mess with it? Just get it filed on time and not worry about it anymore, even if there's an extension.
I like what you said, Andy. What is the consequences of filing late and being wrong? You don't want to find out, folks. Just do not miss that filing date. Alice, a quick, that's a really good point. I want to come back to the DE issue. There's been a lot of talk about the DEs, and I've had some people saying with old DEs like mine, I got mine in 19, I'm a DE underwriter from 1978. Is there any change at HUD that you're aware of that DEs, once a DE, always a DE, or is there a refreshing, any classes that are now being required to keep yourself current or certified?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that some of the numbers are so old, like I'm not sure I could look up, they could look up mine anymore, like yours, you know, because we got them so long ago. I still know mine, though. But the idea of the of an individual person is not DE approved anymore. You get
That's
an
right.
ID number. It's the company that is approved.
That's right.
And it is the company that says, you as an individual are authorized to do FHA loans at my shop. And that is such a huge distinction that lenders have to be aware of, that, you know, just because someone has an ID number, they could have been at a shop where somebody said, here, let me put your name in the system. I need someone else signing off on these loans. And, you know, and that person was really not properly trained on FHAs. We've heard horror stories on that.
Yes.
Someone's walking around with an ID number and they don't really know what they're doing when it comes to FHA. So there is, and no training company is allowed to say that they issue a DE certification. That's false advertising. FHA has actually come out and now is, you know, in bold lights. No company can use their logo, and they don't certify anybody. The company has to, that you are employed by, has to certify that you're qualified. That's how that works.
That is important for you, the companies out there that have DE approvals, to be aware of it. Also, the circle the date on your calendar, May 20th, coming up right around the corner, minimum net worth, unless you qualify for the exempt status of and that's established through the defined as by the SBA, Small Business Administration. Is that correct?
Yes. And then for this category, it's $7 million in gross revenue, I believe.
So, all right, got a couple good dates. That's an interesting update. A lot of great information, Alice. So many people. I find myself going back and listening to the program just to get all the updates. And I've got your notes. I think it's all the extra commentary that you throw in on the program that's so, so valuable. Thank you, Alice.
Hey, Dave.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, I just wanted to expand a little bit on Alice's notes and get her thoughts on the fact on the HUD versus Deutsche Bank and mortgage IT. That a lot of what they're pointing to seems to be based on the annual certifications that every company has to sign that say that they've complied with FHA guidelines, et cetera, and they've implemented the appropriate internal audit quality control programs. And I know every company has to do that, Alice, and so I guess I wonder, every company that signs that, I'm sure they have a breach of that certification, meaning that there's a loan or there's maybe 10 loans or maybe there are 100 loans that didn't go through the process as they would have liked and maybe don't meet the guidelines. Is there a sense of degree of tolerance that you can live with or HUD can live with, or do you have a sense that maybe HUD's taking a position that there's very little tolerance?
Well, I think in any case, you have to try and draw the line, and as a lender, you would be responsible for defending it. Was it false, or did I just simply have a mathematical error in the file, right? You know, or was it unintended? And so when you get to this level of systemic errors, you start to lose, 39,000 mortgages is what they're going after. There must have been some flaw in the process, and I certainly have I'm not privy to any of the information in the case. So if I'm an underwriter and I make, I come up with $5,000 a month for income, HUD looks at the file and says, no, you really should have done $4,800, that's not going to be false. That's a different view of it. And so I think that's the fine line lenders have to be careful of, is that you have good quality control systems in place and you respond to QC's coming up, as the example, with this lower income, the underwriter came up with this. What's the logical reason and what is the follow-up that we have to make sure is in place so this doesn't keep occurring? That's what starts to get HUD, where they start to think things are false because there's nothing to show management was properly enforcing it. And again, that's not specific to this case, just in general.
That is interesting. Folks, we've got to move on to the next segment here. We've got the Prophet Doctor coming up here in just a minute. I want to bring up, we're going to have another discussion. There's another thing that I've just learned that I've been saying is going to happen in the industry that's related to lawsuits, and you're not going to want to miss the Hot Topics segment when I get into that. It was something that I hadn't planned on, but as I hear you talking, Al, especially you talk about the Deutsche Bank lawsuit, it is really important that we do a thorough analysis of the legal risk, another risk in the business. And that target has just grown massively. Alice, thank you so much for hosting the program last week and then bringing us all this information each and every week. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals providing classroom and web-based delivery and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's David Lickin'.
Welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for so many of you shooting over comments saying you really enjoy the program. That's so informative. And when I was walking around the conference last week, I got so many people that pulled me aside and go, listen to your program all the time. Great information. We thank you all for your positive comments. Well, you've all heard about Aesop's Fables, and our famous prophet doctor has been studying the Aesop fables and is now creating his own set of Aesop fables. And so here is the first Aesop or prophet doctor fable, The Brick and the Balloon. Andy Schell, good to have you
well,
with
thanks,
us.
Ed.
What on
yeah.
earth, a brick and the balloon? This is going to be good.
I had a couple. I had an Aesop's fable I used a month or so ago, too. It's a great way to build a word picture for people to understand accounting, because when we start talking about accounting and bottom lines and running your numbers, just, you know, eyes roll back in the head and people just shut down.
Yeah.
So word pictures are really effective at doing this. And so I'm going to use the brick and the balloon as a way of conveying some important aspects of accounting, things people need to know about running their business. And so a brick's an easy to get an image of. It's a fixed shape and size. It's heavy. You know, it takes a hammer and a chisel to change the shape. I built a brick driveway a couple of years ago, and it was the driveway was perfect, had a perfect bed, perfect stand. Everything was great until I got to the end and had to cut the bricks around the perimeter. And, man, that was difficult. It was messy. And actually, I used a masonry blade and a saw. But still, chiseling bricks are hard. Bricks are firm and rigid. And a balloon, you think about a balloon. They're pretty, and they float if they have helium in them. And they're variable size. They get bigger, and then they get smaller. And if there's more volume in there, they get bigger, and then they get smaller. So they automatically change sizes as the amount of space, air inside the balloon changes. So it's not difficult to change the shape of a balloon. You just let the air out. So a brick is solid and it's not flexible. And a balloon is flexible and it changes sizes easily. So now that you've got this image in your head, and so, Dave,
okay.
What
yep.
color is the balloon?
It's blue.
Oh, man. Okay, well, mine was red, but still, nevertheless. Well,
yours red. Yeah, I was thinking yours. You would have red balloons. That's right.
Well, what color is the brick?
That's
okay, moving on.
The red brick, maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
Put you on the spot. Okay, so anyway, these images are important to understand the character of expenses in a company. You know, there's different kinds of expenses in a company, and accountants have gone to a great extent to identify all kinds of different expenses, and partly to make things more complicated, and partly because it helps to understand the character of expenses within a business. And so we've got fixed expenses, which are like bricks, and we've got variable expenses, which are like balloons. So we've got balloons and bricks in the company, fixed cost, variable cost. All companies have fixed and variable cost. And when you add all the fixed costs and all the variable costs together, you get total cost or total expense. So it's important to understand these elements, and it's important to understand this because in a mortgage banking environment, changes in production, changes in volume affect the bottom line, and we need to understand how fixed expenses and variable expenses work together to affect our cost per loan. So Here's a little bit about the character of fixed expenses, just so we're all on the same page about this brick. So fixed expenses do not change as volume or units change. Remember, it's a brick. So
it's a brick.
It's a brick. Fixed costs are like rent, copier, leases, underwriter salaries. It's any fixed cost that stays the same every month. Like fixed costs stay the same no matter what happens, the changes in volume. I mean, like your landlord probably doesn't care if within your, you know, 500 square foot office, if you have three people in there or 13 people in there, the landlord doesn't care, and it's the same cost no matter how many people fill up the space. So fixed costs are accounted for as what we call operating expenses within the profit and loss statement of a mortgage company, and fixed costs are a very important KPI that we've talked about before.
Yep.
So KPI, key performance indicator. So now variable costs. Variable costs change as volumes or units change. So the more units there are, the more costs there are. So variable costs would be like a pure commission, DULP polls, credit report polls. Anything that changes directly as volume changes are variable costs. The variable costs go up when volume goes up, and they go down when volume goes down. So that they change with volume, like the balloon. More air, it gets bigger. Less air, it gets smaller. And so variable costs we account for in accounting as cost of sales for the most part. And it's on the P&L of a mortgage company statement, just below revenue, cost of sales. And this is important because, well, one, it's part of the components of the call report. But two, cost of sales is important because it's substantially the variable cost, and it's what drives gross profit. And gross profit tells us how much revenue we have to cover operating expenses. So I'm getting a little bit deeper with that point. But it's important to understand the character of how all these fit together. So, and just to make it more complicated, some expenses are combinations of fixed and variable expenses, like an originator commission with a base salary. So the base is a fixed expense, and the commission is a variable expense. So I'm talking about this because it's important for mortgage companies to understand this as we're all dealing with changes in volume. So when we work with mortgage companies, and we look at profit per loan. Well, now, profit per loan includes all the revenue per loan. It also includes less the variable expenses and an allocation of the fixed expenses per loan. So this allocation starts getting into direct versus indirect costs, which we'll have to come up with another ESOP table for direct and indirect. So today we're just on variable and fixed. Accountants have all kinds of ways of coming up with stuff. So here's the part that starts getting a little bit complicated. If you know your total cost per loan from last month and your volume changes in this next month, then that means that your variable cost went down, but your fixed cost stayed the same, so you have to recalculate your cost per loan. If volume goes down, variable costs go down, but fixed costs stay the same, so the cost per loan actually went up. And obviously the inverse is true as well. If volume goes up, variable costs go up, fixed costs stay the same, so the total cost per loan actually went down, because the amount of fixed costs are now spread over a larger base. Okay, that part I understand. That was a complicated concept. Suffice it to say, it's important to recalculate this every month. Get the accounting department to recalculate cost per loan every single month. It's important to know this because variable costs change with volume, but fixed costs don't. So the total cost per loan has to be recalculated. So if you know your cost per loan...
Yeah, and when market conditions are causing for lower volumes right now, probably more critical than ever.
Exactly. That's part of the point why this is coming up. So if you knew your cost per loan last month, forget it. Recalculate it again because it's probably changed. It's guaranteed that it'll change whenever volumes change. So it's not that complicated to calculate. Get the accounting department to calculate, and I think the best way to look at it is to get a good dashboard system to report the information. So, like you just mentioned, Dave, here's why this is an important point for today. There's volume changes happening all across the industry. And when there are significant changes in volume, it's important to realize that the variable costs will automatically change, but the fixed costs will not change. Fixed costs do not change on their own. They must be changed. Fixed costs have to be acted upon to change. It's like chiseling the brick. When volume drops by 50%, there's no choice but to force fixed costs to change. You have to force fixed costs to adjust to changes in volume. So which fixed costs do you change? Well, you know, there's rent, there's copier leases, there's salaries, once you figure out what you're going to change, how much are you going to change them? Well, here's the deal. The only way to know how much to change your fixed cost when you have changes in volume is to have a defendable estimate about the future volume. You know, when I was at Bank of America, we ran models that had thousands of permutations, and then we ran probability-weighted outcomes to arrive at the various forecasts. I can assure you, Dave, that today the big mortgage companies have all forecasted their business. Even given unpredictable times, they are still forecasting their business, and they know what they're going to change and how they're going to change it if volume levels change. They've already figured it out. So today, if the listeners on the show do not have a financial forecast that's based on defendable estimates of future volumes, it's essential. You've got to have one. It's essential to have one. If you don't have one, call us. We can help. You've got to have this. So if volume is expected to fall, it is important to know in advance what you're going to change. And anticipating changes in volume and having a plan to implement the change is really essential. You know, we call this a change management plan. Financial forecast is an important part of it, but your change management plan means it's like a fire drill plan. You've already anticipated,
yep,
volume goes down. What am I going to do? You know, we can't predict change, but we can manage through the change when it happens. And having a change management plan is essential for every mortgage company that is subject to changes in volume. So wait, which mortgage companies aren't subject to changes in volume? Well, none,
yeah,
right? So
none.
Everybody needs one of these things. Everybody needs a change management plan. Everybody needs a forecast based on permutations and volume. So come up with different versions, and you know, don't necessarily need to go through all of the harangue that we went through at B of A, but have some idea that's a defendable assumption about where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. You know, sometimes chiseling the brick includes layoffs, and layoffs are always challenging. They always impact people's lives significantly. We don't want to do it randomly, but we want to do it carefully, and having a good change management plan will help to make the transition as smooth as possible. It's not going to be an easy change, but it's a change that can be done well. So it's important to understand the components of total expense and the relationship between fixed and variable expenses, balloons and bricks, to effectively adjust changes in volume. Every time your volume changes, your cost per loan changes because your fixed costs don't change. And then using a financial forecast to predict, you know, how much to chisel, and then also using a change management plan to work through all these essential elements are important to survive in this, I don't know what you call it, David, ever more rapidly changing world, or
yep,
turn around the next day and Alice has another list of things that just happened. So things are happening faster than we can keep up with it. Volumes are changing. Plan, adapt, adjust, have an idea about what you're going to do. And that's the profit doctor for the day today, Dave.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's such an important point to have that plan. I like the analogy is when there's a fire in the building, they have a map on every door that says, go down the hall, turn right, and you go down. If you're in this part of the building, you go down this exit, set of stairs or whatever, and here's where you go, and you gather outside. I mean, that's why we have these plans. And it's amazing to me the number of companies that don't do just the basics, which it seems to be so common sense out there. So we'll be talking.
And the scary part, too, Dave, is if somebody had a cost per loan that they calculated last summer and their volume's down and they're still applying that same cost per loan and wondering whether they're not making any money, it's because it's not right anymore. If the volume went down, the cost per loan number has to change because it will have gone up a lot because the fixed costs will not have gone down until they're forced to go.
There you have it. There you have it. The brick and the balloon. I like that, Andy. Variable versus fixed. That's excellent. I like it. Thank you so much for bringing that to us each and every week. And I got a lot of people walking to me up at the conference and going, that profit doctor does an amazing job, very creative. So few people know just how creative you are. So we get a little insights on that each and every week here on The Profit Doctor. Folks, we'll be right back after this brief break.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success, Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging,
financial and accounting services,
or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
PMI Mortgage Insurance Company is the clear choice for your higher LTV conventional borrowers. Unlike FHA, PMI offers a choice of flexible premium plans to fit the individual needs of each borrower. From a one-time upfront cost with no renewal premium to a monthly plan with no upfront charges, PMI's premium plans recognize larger down payment and good credit history, saving your clients what can at times be thousands of dollars. PMI also provides lenders with fast electronic submission tools to increase efficiencies. Mortgage insurance is more relevant than ever, so it's important to utilize a mortgage insurer who's committed to the business for the long term. It is vital that you work with a company whose core competency is credit risk management and bring that wealth of knowledge to your firm. At PMI, mortgage insurance is their only business, so they have to get it right. PMI's mission is to create sustainable homeownership opportunities. To learn more about how PMI solutions can assist your business, please contact your PMI representative today or call 800-966-4PMI, 800-966-4PMI.
Welcome back. This is David Licken with Licken on Lending. It was good to be in New York City, and I attended so many of the receptions that are there, one of which was PMI. We really appreciate their sponsorship of this program. They make it possible to bring this to you, as well as does DMD, Wetzel Trott, and so does Tony Garitano out there who's helping us, and he'll be on the program giving us a report from New York here in just a little bit. Folks, it was a really interesting conference again, but I want to say thank you to Alice for hosting the show while I was gone last week. Alice, if
you're welcome.
It's always appreciated when you step in there and do that for us.
Yeah. Well, Dave, tell us about the conference. So, I know you, you know, what was the mood like at the conference?
Well, first of all, it was well attended, and it's always encouraging when you see an industry conference well attended. What was notable about it were several things. Number one is the number of banks that were present there were probably in greater majority than we've seen in years past, especially during the really go-go days of the mortgage industry. We see less independents, but there's still some good independent mortgage companies there. And what's really interesting, Alice, is that Andy's to the brick and the balloon. It's those that are doing well are those that adjusted their cost structure early on. So we talk to different ones. I walk up to them and say, how's your business? I'm talking about independents now. I walk up to them and say, how's your business? And they go, we're actually doing really well, profitable. I mean, some of the numbers, the earnings that some of them reporting were very, very encouraging. And others came up, and but the vast majority of them said, volume is off. I sure don't want to repeat the first quarter again from an earnings standpoint. That gave us a big owie, and it hurt at the bottom line. So I think it really is an indication of those companies that do make adjustments. That's one thing that was probably notable. Alice, the other thing that was really interesting out there is the number. I'd ask a number of companies, I mean a number of companies saying, so how are you or how are your customers preparing for the call report? And you get this response, call report? Missed something. What are you talking about? And that probably, Alice, was it was most interesting. There's just a lot of people that are just not plugged into this. And then after we're covering it on the radio program, but it's just astounding. And I'm wondering if that's not an indication of just kind of what's going on in the whole industry. As far as you're out there speaking, so love to get everyone's thoughts on that. But it's just I think people are either overwhelmed. Well, Joe, what was your comments when we were talking on the radio beforehand? Is it just overwhelmed, or what were the comments you said?
Well, I think that everyone tries their best to do what they can, but there's just been so much, and overwhelmed's a good word. It's you know, they've just gotten through LO Comp, and you know the April 1st. Time frame was just the beginning of a lot of the discussions about what actually was done. And so, you know, it's hard to say that's over, and you're trying to look at Dodd-Frank, you're trying to deal with tighter underwriting guidelines, and it's harder to get loans through. So, yeah, I think it is a matter of people are overwhelmed, and it's hard to imagine another, filing to do.
Well, I don't even think they've really settled on LO Comp yet. There seems to be still several unanswered questions, especially in the wholesale broker, you know, arrangements. Mm-hmm. So I think people are still trying to feel like they're on firm ground with that. They're getting close, but there's still some inconsistencies out there. you know, people are going, well, are you allowed to do this? Are you not allowed to do that? And, you know, like you said, I think they need to take a break.
No, they're just exhausted. I mean, they're litigation worn out. I'm trying to find the right word to find another L word egg slip in there. But people are just worn out and overwhelmed. And you find different ones, and they've come back with a question, well, how are you staying on top of this? It's just astounding. Right? So we obviously tell them tune into the radio program. But I think that's
I have a vision that comes to mind in all of this, and that's that it's like when the house lands and Wizard of Oz, Dorothy's in the house lands, Dorothy's holding Toto, she leans over and says to Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. And
you know what?
That's where we are now. We're not in Kansas
anymore. And she wandered in circles for a while, not really knowing what direction to go in. So maybe that's where we're at. Good analogy, Andy.
Yeah. Great analogy.
Where's the yellow brick
road? Tornadoes. You know, you look at what rolled through Alabama, different parts of the country, and the devastation of tornadoes, and I think that's what a lot of people feel. I mean, I think that's an excellent description of what a lot of people are going. They're coming out, and they're walking in circles for a period of time, and then they're looking for where to go and how can they digest this. So there was a lot of real honest discussion amongst everyone there, and as people started dropping their guard, and you know, you have convention speak where you go up and you present everything in the most favorable light possible. But as people got in, we were in the various, you know, huddled around in the bars and all the lobby and all the place where all the real conversation really goes on, which I think is the real conference, is it was really interesting, the number of people that were really just talking about everything that's coming out there. There was that rumor, and I'm glad we've dispelled that, is that there was a rumor, a lot of rumors running around about the fact that the call report had been delayed. And, again, no evidence of that. So I'm so glad that we are encouraging everyone to...
Just to be fair, Dave, it is possible that some state did it, but that didn't mean it changed on a national basis. So
good point.
Proceed as
good
otherwise,
point.
I would say.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. What is the consequence of being wrong? You don't want to find out. It's just way too much. And I think the other thing that is, I thought on our pre-radio program call that was so good, was the fact that there is a lot of talk about a number of people not renewing their license. I mean, in fairly interesting, astounding percentages. But we were talking about that. And so a lot of people are talking production is down. How are we recruiting? The loan officers or the production people that were there at the conference were saying things like, well, we thought the future was at the banks. The banks clearly don't have the compensation plans, and we're back to looking at the independent mortgage banking company. So I think the advantage when it comes to production and picking up the top people is definitely going back to independent mortgage bankers. And, Alice, I think you've heard similar things, have you not?
Well, obviously you have people with different viewpoints. Certainly the community banks think they have the product and the assets and, you know, they have some advantages over some of the lenders. But like you said, in a lot of cases when they start sitting down and comparing comp plans, you know, that's where the ultimate dollars come out for the LOs. And so a lot of them are looking at the lenders. But, you know, again, they have to have some time under their belt, to Andy's point about managing in this new environment on what their costs and their overhead are. Some of them came out with some pretty aggressive plans. We don't know if they're sustainable. So, you know, just a lot of change going on. And some people are saying, can I stay in this business? We've been talking about some of the folks who are saying, you know what, I think I'm just going to retire now. that license fallout isn't necessarily good people leaving the business. There's lots of things within that that might cause it.
You may call them opportunists. They were in there when the market was hot, and now they're not active. They really haven't been active. And I think to Joe's point, something Joe mentioned on the radio program or on our conference call before the radio program is, you know, even we're hearing numbers as high as 90%. I mean, Doug Foster, who's the head regulator for Texas, said that he's seeing as many as 90% of the originators are not renewing their license. But, Joe, you were making a point about the number of subscribers to your service, which was a very encouraging number. You're not losing customers. In fact, you're having net gains.
No. We're having net gains every month, and that leads me to the belief that there were many people out there who were occasional originators who did it on a one-off basis, or who did it as a sideline, or you know, who just have said it's not worth it anymore, and the hassles far exceed the opportunities. So nowhere near. I mean, I look around the companies in Texas that I know well, and they're growing originators. So I think that that number is grossly exaggerated by the fact that there were so many people in the business that, that weren't really in the business.
And I don't think they're tracking necessarily who's moving from originator just to a registrant, from a licensee to a registrant. You know, a lot of companies have moved to entities that where they don't have to be licensed anymore, or a lot of people, I should say.
Absolutely. Andy?
Well, I think Joe makes a good point. We're seeing, whether if it's in Florida or in Texas, we're seeing a substantial decline in registrants, but we're not, from a fairly narrow sampling, I'm seeing volumes or quantities of originators at our client base is not actually going down. It's actually going up. And it may be that our sample is skewed because we're only it's kind of positively adversely or positively selecting because it's only those that are surviving, so we're eliminating all the adverse selection group. But because there's all the people that are no longer in business that are now gone. So it's an interesting observation that things are still. We have all these licensees gone, but our companies that we support are growing. So I got to process that a little bit more.
Well, I think it's just a data point. Number one is if you're hearing the statistics, again, in Florida, we did get an updated statistic just yesterday from one of the officials in Florida that said that there are only 13% of the people that had license have renewed it. I think this is a testimony, like Joe was saying, that's just a testimony to the number of people that came into this industry during the best of times, and they were inactive and they're going away. So, folks, do not be moved by that number and stay tuned in. I'm looking. We have 9 minutes. There's a couple things I want to get to real important. We've been warning everybody. Al's been talking about the regulation. We're talking about the fact that all the regulations that are out there and how poorly they're written, the ambiguity in the language of the laws that are there or coming down the line is opening the door for the plaintiff bar. We have been warning our clients, I know Alice and on this radio program are saying, definitely do your work and figure out the legal risk of your company. We've been saying, and Andy, when he spoke at the Texas Mortgage Bankers Educational Conference a few weeks ago, there was Andy, I'll let you just share that one warning about them phishing, people calling and phishing. Could you discuss that a little bit? Because I want to go with it. We're actually seeing evidence of it. We have material evidence now that this is actually going on. So go ahead.
Sure. One of the attorneys that was presenting at the conference indicated that he's heard of lawyers calling mortgage companies, talking to the processors or talking to the originators, and asking them very leading questions about some of their disclosure practices, some of their cost structure, just all kinds of things. And what they believe is happening is that they're looking for errors. They're trying to find examples of violation of all the new rules. And so the attorney's recommendation is if that ever happens, try to get their name and number and report them to the bar. But it's happening. It's out there. Dave, you've been, I don't want you to call you a conspiracy theorist, but you've been talking about this for a while. We now have kind of more confirmed evidence that the plaintiff bar is active and looking.
Yeah, and matter of fact, on Friday, one of our clients emailed me this and sent me an email and says, Dave, when you're right, you're right. I hate it. And the fact is they sent me a mailer. That looks like a direct mail piece that we, the lenders, used to send out. It's a direct mail piece to all of their borrowers that they had made loans to in the last 5 years that says, it was a firm that was doing discovery, and they were misleading. They said a class action lawsuit is pending if you feel that you did not get, you know, were not treated right, and they were phishing, just all kinds of things in that. And I'll get more specific on that, some of the language of it, because I just got handed that. They were clearly phishing about that, and they said, here's the key words. It is possible for you need to respond by this date, number one. Number two, it is possible that your loan will be forgiven. You may have been wrong and suffered. I mean, it's all the classic language we hear in solicitations like this. Like, look at, you know, a lot of the news programs have these solicitations on mesothelioma. That's one of the ones that we see on the television a lot lately. It's that kind of chasing, trying to drum up some activity. Folks, it's live. We're actually seeing mailers being sent to us by our clients on that point. So underscore that.
One thing on that? There are some nooks and crannies and different regulations that we didn't really worry too much about when your operation was running smoothly and most of your loans performed. and you really need to take a new look at your compliance. One quick example is the $35 tolerance for your finance charges on your truth in lending if the loan's in foreclosure. Most people have always lived with there's a $100 tolerance within your amount financed that's used to calculate the APR. Well, there's actually a little teeny piece in that law that changes that down to 35 in the event the borrower's in foreclosure and pays the loan in full. It's a real tiny little piece, but you kind of go, oh boy, I got to go take a look at that for exactly what you're saying. A lot of fishing going on for small little parts in regulations that you might not be paying attention to.
And it's scary that actually. Yeah, they all exist. And here, to see a flyer that's being sent out to one of our clients' entire database of all the loans they had made, they somehow can secure that database. It's scary, folks. You need to pay attention to it. Also attending the conference this last week was Tony Garitano. I ran into him several times. We have him on the program, and we're so excited to have him here with us. And if I can get up here and turn on his microphone, I'll actually get him to be a part of it. Tony, good to have you on the program. Would love to talk to you. I know you heard a lot of the same talk about loan top originators and what the industry average are. What was some of the chatter you heard at the conference?
Well, first, Dave, it was great to run into you. I wish we had more time, but it was a busy conference, and I agree that there was a lot of good information. One of the things that I came across was this study by Mortgage Success Source that I wanted to share. And it said that the top 15% of originators produced more than seven times the volume of average or even above average originators. So the top 15% are doing a lot of business, and they're doing it really well.
Yeah, and who put out this report?
It was by Mortgage Success Source.
Okay. Well, I'll hear more about them. That's a new group out there that I'm not familiar with. So was there any insight on how do top originators spend their time?
Well, it said that disproportionately top originators said they spend at least 33% of their time acquiring new customers and maintaining relationships. Also, top producers spend at least 30% of their time acquiring new information that raises their professional knowledge and is directly applicable for their clients.
Yeah.
And that interests me, that last point, Dave, because that knowledge is power. And it seems to me that if you have more technology and you're drawing technology from different sources to be a more educated originator, you can use that to drive, you know, more volume if you're actually out there using some of this technology.
Well, I know Pat Sherlock spoke at one of the production. There was a joint, the secondary marketing conference and the production conference were simultaneous, and they were going on at the same time. She spoke at the production, one of the production seminars, and she talked about social media and some of the technology. What do you see as far as technology enabling and helping producers produce more?
Well,
produce better.
Social media is certainly an up-and-coming technology. I mean, LinkedIn, Facebook. Even Twitter is very popular. They've got lots of people there. There's a lot of reach there. And you got to go where the borrower is, and you got to be creative. So I think stepping out of your comfort zone to really look into things like social media and to do what you can to educate yourself about the type of borrower that you want to be doing business with is really the way to go, because they're not going to come to you anymore. You got to go to them.
You got to go to them. That is such a good one. I'm thinking, I'm chuckling when you said step out of your comfort zone. Start a radio program, never having done a radio program before. That's for sure. That's what's taking you outside your comfort zone for sure. Tony, any parting words for us as we go to the door here? We got just a few seconds left.
Well, I would say 70% of LOs are eager to get more technology, so that should be a message to institutions to keep implementing new tools.
Go on out, check it out more. You go to progressinlending.com, and you can learn more about what's being written about and reported about by Tony Garitano. So good to have you on the program each and every week, Tony. It's good to see you in New York City. Everybody, we look forward to be back with you next week as we hear from the Profit Doctor. We hear about the legislative traffic report as we hear get an update on interest rates and all that's going on. We appreciate you being with us. Pass the word around. Have a great week, everyone.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Licken of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.